MacCast, Tuesday, August 9th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got a feature-packed show for you today. A bunch of Lion stuff, of course, some information about Apple potentially replacing the Magic Mouse, some thoughts on iTunes streaming services for movies, and a really interesting story out of China about some creative smugglers. All that and your tips and tricks, some feedback on my macOS 10 consumerification rant from the last episode, and a bunch of my observations, things that I've run into since using Lion for a couple weeks. It's not all roses. Let's just say that. That's your little teaser. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, this is a really great application for IT administrators, for people in the education environment, for your business. If you have systems, Macs or PCs, that you need to deploy into an environment, and especially if they're going to be used by multiple users, so a school lab environment is a great example of this, or if you're in the hospitality industry and you want to put Macs in your hotel rooms, Deep Freeze is great for that, because what you can do is you can set up that system, put on all the applications, all the utilities, all the things that you need to install on it, and then lock it down, make it a clean, pristine system. You freeze it with the Deep Freeze software, and that sets that configuration in stone, sets it in place. And then what happens is that your customers, your users, can use that system. It doesn't restrict access to those areas while it's in session, while they're using it. But any changes made to those frozen areas aren't permanent. So what happens is the minute you reboot that system, it restores it back to its original frozen state, the state that you put it in. Now, if you need to have areas where users can save data, persistent data between those sessions, you define something called a thaw space. And that can be a folder, a partition, an entire volume, an external volume if you want. And anything saved into those areas is kept. It's retained between sessions. And you can even, if you're an administrator, set it up so that you can easily reboot into a thawed state. So if you need to install new applications, utilities, software, stuff like that, you can do that as an administrator, but the users aren't going to be able to persist that data in those locations. You can even set up sessions and automate the process. So if you want to have it nightly go out and do check for a software update and install that, you can set all of that up. It's really easy to do. Another application potentially is trying out software. If you're in a home environment, how many of us have had that new, pristine, clean system and we just want to try an app? But the minute you install it, it goes out and puts stuff into little crevices and corners of your system folder, your library folders. You don't know where that stuff went. Well, if you were running with Deep Freeze on, you could still install that software. It could put everything in the places it needs to within your system. But then if you suddenly decide, you know what, I don't want to keep this app, you simply reboot. It will wipe away all that stuff, put it back in the pristine condition. If you decide you want to keep the app, well, just simply reboot into a thawed state, reinstall the app, and you're good to go. The application was recently updated for Lion, so completely Lion compatible in the new version, and that just shows how much they really support Macs and the product. You know, there's a lot of other companies who haven't upgraded for Lion yet, but Phoronix was there and ready with the Deep Freeze product. So cross-platform supports virtualization, so if you use Parallels, VMware Fusion, you can freeze that stuff as well, and you can get more information and details over on their website, Phoronix.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So lots of interesting stuff happening in the Mac news this week. Cult of Mac had a story. Actually, it was a rumor followed by a correction. What was going on was they had a tip that said Apple might be thinking about discontinuing their Magic Mouse in favor of the Magic Trackpad. We've been hearing rumors since the announcement of Lion with all its new gesture-based features that Apple might be trying to kill off the mouse, get rid of that, saying multi-touch trackpads, that's the way we're going to be going in the future. And so it was thought that they were getting rid of it and there was just going to be the Magic Trackpad. Well, later they came back and revised the site. It turns out It's looking like the Magic Mouse is staying around, but might be getting a new model number. Again, at least according to Cult of Mac, although 9to5 reported a counter-argument saying that the part number for the original Magic Mouse has not been discontinued, which was the premise of this whole rumor, that it's still around, but there could also be a new model number, maybe indicating that there might be an update coming for the Magic Mouse. The assumption is that the Magic Mouse Part 2 would get better support for Lion's new gestures. Now, I'm not really sure how that would work out, because I'm a Magic Mouse user, and I've already commented on the fact that there's some discrepancies just in the UI or in the multi-touch gestures between a Magic Mouse and a trackpad. The typical instance is that most of the time when you would use three fingers to do a gesture on the trackpad, that same thing translates into a two-finger gesture on the Magic Mouse. Not 100%. There's some little tricks and idiosyncrasies in there. Luckily, Apple makes it pretty easy, because if you go into the system preferences into either the mouse or the trackpad, they give you little hints on how to. They've got those little videos running on how to do the different gestures on the different types of input devices. So that's nice, but I can't imagine trying to do, say, like a three-finger gesture on a Magic Mouse. So even if they enabled it with more multi-touch touch points on the surface, just getting three fingers on a Magic Mouse would be really difficult. I even have trouble right now with two-finger gestures on my Magic Mouse as it is. So I don't know if there'd be some side buttons or some additional touch points that are maybe around the side of the mouse. I have no idea how they would actually modify it for better multi-touch gesture support, but Apple often has creative ideas that I can't think of. If you have any thoughts on it, how we can build a better Magic Mouse, let me know. But sounds like we might be getting a new one in the future, and that it's not actually going away. Apple may be getting set to put out a new version of the 21-inch iMac, but it may or may not be available for you to buy. It depends on, one, if the product ever materializes, and two, if you're an educational customer of Apple. 9to5Mac noted over the weekend that a Tech Info article showed up in Apple's support website that makes reference to a new iMac being offered to educational customers. It would be priced $200 below the current entry-level iMac at $999, and it's the 21-inch model. It comes with a 3.1 gigahertz dual-core i3 Intel processor, 2 gigs of RAM, a 250-gigabyte hard drive, and the AMD Radeon HD 6750 graphics with 256 megabytes of RAM. Now, the price point sounds great, less than $1,000, well, a buck less than $1,000, but when you start comparing it to the current low-end consumer version, it doesn't really add up, because with that model for just the $200 more at $1,199 US, you get the 21-inch screen, 2.5 gigahertz quad-core i5 Intel chip, 4 gigs of RAM, a 500-gigabyte hard drive, and the 6750 Radeon graphics card, HD graphics card, with 512 megabytes of RAM. So pretty much everything is doubled. You get 4 cores versus 2, 4 gigs of RAM versus 2 gigs of RAM, twice the hard drive, and twice the video memory for just $200 more. And I know that schools have really tight budgets, and maybe this would be appealing to them, but you're going to get much more bang for the buck just getting the entry-level Mac. And maybe Apple has second-guessed their thoughts on this, because this still hasn't shown up on the educational online store. I just checked a few minutes ago, and it's still not showing up in the system, but a bunch of the sites said it was available. I think the unofficial Apple weblog even said it was already available for sale. I can't find it anywhere. So if you can, great, but it might not be the best deal, even if you're an educational customer. Seems like Apple's been working hard to revamp iTunes and get it ready for the iCloud, adding specifically the feature to re-download a lot of your media purchases. So right after Apple announced iCloud, or not long after, they upgraded iTunes and you had the ability to re-download your music, your purchased music, either to your iOS devices directly or to your Mac through iTunes. Then just a couple weeks ago, they added the ability to stream your television purchases to the Apple TV 2, and also along with that added the ability to re-download TV shows and episodes to your iOS devices directly or to your Mac, even your previously purchased stuff, so you can go into your history through the iTunes store look at the shows that you purchased and redownload those. There's been rumors for a long time that Apple's been wanting to bring this functionality out for movies, in addition to launching an iTunes movie streaming service to compete with possibly Netflix and companies like that. It was kind of labeled in the media iTunes Replay. Well, an industry insider came out recently and said that's likely not going to happen anytime soon. The report came out on CNET and basically said the issues are the deals with the movie studios, that it's going to take a really long time for Apple to get any of the deals in place that they need to put out a streaming service. And the particular sticking point seems to be something called the HBO window, which is an agreement between three of the major studios, 20th Century Fox, Universal, and Warner Brothers, that gives HBO exclusive rights to the streaming for a period of time after the release, the DVD release. So a DVD goes on sales, and then HBO apparently has exclusive rights to the online streaming. And so I guess because of this situation, Apple reportedly has only reached deals with two out of the six major studios. They're going to have to continue negotiations working with the other ones to try and make something happen. Good news is in the reports I was reading, they say that the parent company of HBO does want to change how this stuff works. I think they want to get their own terms changed, which may benefit Apple and some of the other services who are trying to do streaming movies and streaming content. Although I have to say, it's stories like this that make me believe that companies like Apple and Netflix just ultimately want to cut the studio middlemen out completely, altogether get rid of them, trying to provide a way for content producers, creators, and owners of content to go direct to their digital distribution channels with new content and new TV shows. So I imagine this, it's probably utopian, but I can imagine the day and time when Apple provides an entire end-to-end solution for someone who wants to tell a story, a storyteller, a creative professional, to not only write and set up and do the storyboarding and prepare their content, but also go in and do the filming, the capture, the editing, and the distribution right into the iTunes store and right onto an Apple TV. Or we've already had these rumors about Apple maybe putting out their own television set. I still think that they're going to integrate or try and have television manufacturers integrate the Apple TV technology and chipsets right into the sets. And then at that point, they have an end-to-end distribution model. They've got the giant data center. They've got marketing and distribution and sales through iTunes. They can take their cut for managing their costs and what they need to on top of whatever you sell it for. And you can just go direct with your new movie. You can create the entire thing end-to-end using Apple technology. And I think technically it could happen. I'm sure there's a lot of legal and the studios aren't going to want to let that happen very easily. But Apple seems to be positioning themselves to make that happen, or actually have the ability for that future to happen. Whether or not it will come to be, I don't know. But it seems like, you know, when it takes years and years just to do a deal to put streaming content online, why not just get rid of the roadblock and the red tape altogether? And I think Apple might actually do that. I don't know. Am I crazy? Is it just the podcaster in me, the content creator in me, wanting to do it all myself? I just look at some of the online networks, Revision 3 and what Leo Laporte's doing with the Twit network and stuff like that. And these networks are primed to be the networks of the future, where the creators of the network and the content control the content, and then they also control the sales and the distribution all the way through. They just need a platform for it to be on, and Apple really seems to have that in place. The one major piece that could be missing, and probably where the battle is going to begin, is over the lines, over the pipes. And a lot of the TV studios, Time Warner, you know, owns HBO, they control a lot of the pipes going into a lot of people's houses. So that's where the fight's going to be. The government's already involved in that area. I don't even want to start thinking about that stuff yet. Let's just think about the nice, pretty vision of Apple bringing us our media content, allowing us to create it and then buy it all the way through. And hopefully that other stuff will get sorted out. Probably not, but that's where the lines are going to be drawn, the front lines of the new internet distribution battle, I guess it'll end up being. But if you have thoughts on this, if you think I'm totally crazy, let me know. Or if you agree with me, send me email. Could iOS 5 finally bring true speech-to-text to the iPhone and iOS devices? 9to5 Mac has noted that Nuance-powered speech-to-text features are showing up in the latest beta builds of iOS 5. iOS 5 Beta 5 was released to developers recently, and they apparently found some screens that add a little mic icon next to the space bar on the keyboard, and tapping that reportedly will allow you to do text to speech. You start speaking into the phone, it'll translate that right into your system, and apparently that's all powered by Nuance's Dragon technology, Dragon Naturally Speaking. It's been rumored for a while that Apple's been doing deals with them. We've seen the new voices, the new Nuance International voices, show up in Mac OS X Lion. You can download and install those on demand. So Apple has been certainly working with Nuance in some other areas, and we know that Apple acquired Siri way back when. That's a app that would do natural language processing, so you could talk into your phone and it could make dinner reservations or do map searches, bring up directions and things like that. It would actually process your voice and try and figure out what kinds of searches and stuff that you wanted to do. Some cool technologies Apple has acquired, or companies that they're working with, to make text-to-speech stuff happen. Now, when these screenshots came out, a lot of the sites were kind of reporting that it was right there in iOS 5 beta, apparently only on the iPhone and the iPod Touch. It currently wasn't supported on the iPad. It's not really clear why it wouldn't be supported. I assume that the Dragon Naturally Speaking part is working just like Nuance's own apps, which do require an active internet connection. So that would make sense to tie it to 3G-enabled devices like iPads and iPhones, but I'm not really sure why the iPad's being excluded. Now, 9to5, I don't know where they got their intel, but Mac Rumors was saying that despite the screenshots of the interface and the stuff that 9to5 was showing off, it doesn't actually exist or isn't actually activated by default in iOS 5 beta 5. It's actually a hidden feature, and even if you turn it on and activate it, I haven't discovered the process yet for actually doing that, but there's some process to turn it on and activate it. Once you've done that, it's not functional, so it doesn't even really work. There's just kind of screenshots in there. So who knows if this is a proposed feature, something Apple's playing around with internally and plans to enable at some point, or whether it'll even be part of the final release version of iOS 5 Beta 5. But a lot of people have been really wanting better voice commands, better voice control in iOS, and I think it's about time that Apple adds it in. So it shows promise, but might not quite be there yet, despite what some of the rumor sites seem to be alluding to. Apple continues to push forward in preparing the iCloud for its imminent release. This week, developers were allowed to start transitioning their Mobile Me accounts over to the iCloud. In the past, developers could sign up for a new iCloud account, but it wasn't tied to their Mobile Me account. Now, if they go to me.com/move, and you have to be registered in Apple's developer program to use this feature, you can transition your account. There's some warnings, though, because there's some features that aren't coming over from MobileMe that you will lose when you transition your account. Specifically, the ability to sync widgets, your dock items, your keychains, which is a big one for me. I'm not so sure I want to transition my account away from syncing keychains. That was really helpful when I did my transition to Lion. Signatures, your mail account rules, and your mailboxes, along with your mail preferences. None of that stuff is going to be moved over to iCloud, or at least there's no announcements that that stuff's going to be in there. It's certainly not there in the beta version that Apple's working with right now. So if you are a developer and considering transitioning your account, be aware of that. The good news, though, is that turns out MobileMe Gallery, iDesk, and iWeb Publishing will continue to work even after you transition to the iCloud, at least until Apple discontinues those services, which is going to happen on June 30th, 2012. So you'll be able to continue to use that. Ars Technica also notes that developers with current active paid-for MobileMe accounts, which include 20 gigabytes of storage, if you're on MobileMe for your yearly fees, you get 20 gigabytes of storage and then any additional storage that you might have purchased. But if you just have the standard account and you migrate to the iCloud, Apple's going to add your 20 gigabytes of storage onto the 5 gigabytes that you get for free. So you get 25 gigabytes of total storage for the first year. And if you want to have that storage continue after the first year, you're going to have to pay for that in the new iCloud service. The cost for that 20 gigabytes will run you $40 a year, And if you are transitioned from your Mobile Me account, it looks like it sets you up for auto renewing. So you'll have to turn that off before June 30th, 2012, if you don't want to get charged $40 at that time. You can downgrade your account to the free 5 gigabyte plan. And it's not clear if you do so before June 30th, if you're going to get a prorated refund on your current Mobile Me account. Apple did, when they announced the iCloud, or have a process, I think, for getting a refund on your current Mobile Me account. There's a process you can go through Apple support if you want to get your money back and you just want to use the free iCloud services. But iCloud's going to have 5 gigs storage for free. It's going to allow you to store your documents, your backups, your contacts, your calendars. Email is separate from that, I think, in terms of the storage costs, so you don't have to worry about that there. And you can purchase additional storage. Prices for that is 10 gigabytes for $20 a year, 20 gigabytes for $40 a year, or 100 gigabytes for $50 a year. So as more information and details about the iCloud service become available, I'll try and cover that on the MacCast. We should be getting some more details now that developers are actually able to get a look at some of what's going on. So I'm sure the news and the rumor sites will start putting out details on that, and expect that in future episodes of the MacCast. When Apple announced that Lion was going all digital, a big question a number of people had was, how do you do an emergency boot? And Apple has since given us a lot of details, a lot of options for doing an emergency recovery. There were also some tutorials, I even covered them on the MacCast, on how to create your own emergency boot volume by extracting some of the files from the Lion installer that downloads from the Mac App Store. Well, Apple this week released an official utility for Mac OS X Lion that will let you create recovery disks on externals or USB drives, USB sticks, whatever you'd like to do. The way you do it is, if you want to create an external Lion recovery, download the Lion Recovery Disk Assistant application, which Apple just released. You can get that from their support website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. Insert an external drive, you launch the Lion Recovery Disk Assistant, and then it will ask you to select the drive where you want to install it, and then you simply just follow the on-screen instructions. When it completes, a new partition will be created on that device. It won't be visible in the Finder or via Disk Utility, though. What you'll have to do is reboot your system, holding down the Option key to initiate the option to select the Lion Recovery Volume. You'll select that hard drive or that partition from the startup manager, and then you can boot from that and reinstall Lion. So they've made the process nice and simple and easy. One thing to note that is that in order to create the Lion recovery disk, you do need to have the recovery HD partition in your Lion install. That's the one that automatically gets created when you install Lion. So if for some reason it wasn't unable to create that, like your hard disk was too full, there are instances where that partition is not created, you won't be able to use the Lion Recovery Disk Assistant to create your disk. But that tool is now available, and you can pick it up, as I mentioned, on Apple's support website. And then finally, in the news for this week, an amazing story out of China. It's unbelievable the lengths that someone will go through to make some money. I guess maybe not unbelievable. We all like having cash in our wallets, right? Well, some smugglers in China rigged an elaborate pulley system to move iDevices from Hong Kong into mainland China. I guess there's a price difference based on taxes and things like that. You can get iDevices much cheaper in Hong Kong than you can in China. So what they did is they actually shot a zip line across a river from a skyscraper in Shenzhen over to a house in rural Hong Kong. And then they rigged up this pulley system in a bag to move iPads and iPhones across the river from Hong Kong into China. Police arrested 6 people and confiscated more than 50 iPhones and iPads worth about 300,000 yuan, which translates into about almost $47,000 US. So some good cash on the street in China if you can smuggle those things across. And this is like out of a movie, you know, shooting a crossbow across the river and then dragging this stuff across. I guess always where there's a will, there's a way. But cool, fun little story to end the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take another moment, thank another one of our show sponsors, Gazelle. You know, this is a site. Go to gazelle.com. You can get cash for your old used electronics. They have over 250,000 products now in their database, really simple and easy to do. So if you have an old video camera, an old iPod or something like that, you just type in iPod in the model. It will pop right up. You find the specific version. So say you have a fifth generation iPod, select that. You answer some quick questions about its condition, the types of accessories that you have to send in, and then they give you a cash offer. They even kind of track the prices. It's a cool little graph that shows you, you know, what the trending of the price is, whether it's going up or down and how quickly it's going down. And then if you decide to accept their offer, they cover the shipping costs, and in some cases they'll even give you a box. And what happens once they receive it is they just verify the condition, and if it matches what you put into their system, then you get paid via check, PayPal. You can do a Walmart prepaid Visa card or an Amazon gift card, or even if you'd like, you can have that money donated to one of over 100 charities that they work with. If your item turns out to not have value, they even offer a recycling service, and they use eSteward certified domestic recycler Blue Cloud. So you know your stuff's not going to end up in some landfill overseas, something like that, polluting the environment. So it's a great service, quick and easy to use, and you can get more information and details at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the Metcast. I had a great email question come up this week, and it's something that I'm looking into. I have a partial answer. I don't think I've got to the bottom of the situation, but I thought I'd throw it out to you and see if you might have some ideas beyond what I've been able to find out from Apple. And the question is related to the new MacBook Airs and Mac Minis, the ones that don't have built-in optical drives and are now shipping with Lion pre-installed. And because Lion's pre-installed and Lion has the recovery partition built into it, if you need to restore your operating system, apparently these new machines don't come with any kind of physical media. So there's no emergency boot drive whatsoever, whether it be the USB key that Apple used to ship with the MacBook Airs or DVDs. None of that is in the box. You have no physical media. Interestingly enough, the new MacBook Airs and Mac Minis also do not come with iDVD or iWeb pre-installed as part of the iLife 11 suite. They only include iPhoto, iMovie, and GarageBand, which is the same stuff that Apple sells through the App Store. If you bought the commercial disc version, though, iDVD and iWeb are on there. They're just in the older versions. They weren't updated as part of the iLife 11 suite. So I'm not really sure why the discrepancy there. But the question came up, without any install discs of any kind, how would you reinstall the iLife suite? Because originally the question was, you know, is iDVD and iWeb on there pre-installed? And if not, can I install them? And my answer was, well, yeah, just install them from the original discs. But the person I was emailing with emailed me back and said, well, there are no physical discs, which I hadn't even realized. So I checked with Victor Cahiao from the Typical Mac User podcast, who I knew had a new MacBook Air that came with Lion pre-installed, and also John Martellaro from the Mac Observer. And they both confirmed that, yes, it does not include iDVD or iWeb, and there is no physical media. And then I asked both of them, well, how do you reinstall iLife? If you had a total hard disk failure, you needed to replace your hard drive, or you wanted to do a complete erase and reinstall, even from the recovery partition, how would you get iLife back on there? And our initial thought was, well, it must happen through the App Store. So when you set up your new Mac and you register it and you plug in your Apple ID, it could go out and say, okay, this is one of these new models, pre-register it in the App Store, and then when you launch the App Store, just allow you to re-download those applications and not have to pay for them because they were included, bundled with your system. Well, it turns out I set up a support call with Apple through their Express Lane support, and just as an aside, can I say Express Lane support on Apple is awesome. That's the feature where you can go in and you can actually schedule an appointment to have Apple call you. Rather than trying to call them on the phone and waiting on hold and stuff like that, you can just say, hey, I know I'm going to be home tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. Please give me a call. And they do. They call you right up. As a matter of fact, I got the call and it was an 800 number I didn't recognize on my phone. I didn't pick up on the first ring. Luckily, I checked my voicemail because they said, hey, it's remember your appointment? It's Apple. We're trying to contact you. We'll call you back in 10 minutes. So I was able to talk to a support representative, and in essence, what they confirmed was that the way you would reinstall iLife is you have to use the new internet recovery feature. And I don't know if we mentioned this on the MacCast. I think I mentioned it on the last episode. So these new models, the MacBook Airs and Mac Minis, now have something built right into the firmware on the computer that allows it in an emergency situation. So if you had a total internal hard disk failure and you had no boot disk, it will still boot. You can hold down, I believe it's Command R on startup, and it will go out to Apple's servers and actually boot off Apple's servers and then allow you to re-download and reinstall Lion from scratch. And the representative confirmed that as part of that process with these new models, it will also re-download and reinstall the bundled software, meaning the iLife applications that came with your Mac. So it'll get you back up and running on a clean new system, and then you can run your software updates and get up to date through that. So it sounds like it's not happening through the Mac App Store. Unfortunately, somebody asked me, well, what happens if you don't have an internet connection and you did build an emergency boot installer, say using the new utility that Apple just released today, and you install from that? Will it reinstall the iLife applications then, downloading them through online since it's not through the Mac App Store? And that is what I don't have the answer to. And unfortunately, really, probably the only way to figure it out is to do a complete erase and install on one of these new systems. And I haven't found anybody willing to do that yet. So if you're willing to test it out for me, please make sure you back up your entire system if you're going to go through this process, or maybe you have a need to actually do a reinstall. I'd be very curious to find out how this happens. But it does beg to question, with Apple moving to this direct download, no disks, no optical drives and systems, they're going to have to solve some of these solutions. And I'm not entirely certain that they've thought all of these things entirely through. It sounds like maybe they have, but maybe they haven't. And I'm getting mixed signals depending on who you ask at Apple and who you ask at the Genius Bar, or whether you call AppleCare support or what have you, you get different answers. So we'll try and figure all this stuff out. But for now, that's what I've been able to do, determine. I also got some great feedback on my, people are calling it a rant. I was hoping it wasn't a rant from the last episode, but just the realization, or my trying to wrap my head around Apple sort of consumerizing their products, or making the iOS devices and the Mac and Lion and everything more consumer friendly, kind of hiding the more geeky and lower level features and saying, look, you know what? We know that you geeks who go in and find and want to tweak and tinker and stuff like that, you're going to figure everything out. So even if we go and we hide the library folder, which is a place where if somebody who's an average user gets into and starts messing around, they can really mess up their system. We're gonna protect users from that. We're going to hide it because there really is no reason you need to get in there. Those of you who want to, guess what? You can figure out. There's a couple tricks and ways to figure out, and we've already talked about those, to get in there and do that stuff. Another one I discovered recently is that Apple changed the permissions of the utilities folder in the applications folder in Lion. You are now not allowed, even as an admin, to just place or install stuff into the utilities folder. You actually have to get heightened permissions. It's owned by the system, by root. And so even as an administrator, to put an application into the utilities folder in the main applications folder, you get prompted for permissions. And I verified that. I looked into the permissions on that folder, and it's definitely changed. Now, again, I, as a power user, I know that I can go in and I can modify the permissions. There's a bunch of things I can do if I want to install stuff into that folder. But Apple is saying to the average user, look, the utilities folder is for stuff that is specific to Apple. If you want to install applications, all applications, utilities or otherwise, that you're installing go into the applications folder. That's the area that we've designated. And that's going to help most average users, I think, stay safe. So I kind of talked about that whole process and deciding that more and more now I'm starting to question why I would fight Apple's decisions. Because if you go with Apple's methodology, it makes upgrading, it makes using your applications, it makes the whole user experience just work. And it's kind of the trade-off that you have to go through to have that ability, that consumer level ability for technology to just pick it up and just work. Apple says if you use these conventions, if you stay in our sandbox, and I understand that not everybody loves the sandbox, but if you stay in our sandbox, we're going to be able to keep you better protected, more secure, and you're going to know that your stuff's going to just work. So more and more when I make tweaking decisions, what the conclusion I came to was that I was going to base my decisions on usage and not just because I can, not just doing that cool tech thing because, hey, look at this cool utility. It adds this functionality and then I throw it in there and I play with it for 5 minutes and then I never use it again. But there it is sitting in my system, especially low level stuff like system preferences and menu bar tweaks and stuff like that. And then it's just clogging up my system and I'm not taking advantage of it. So I'm going to say, am I really going to use this feature or tweak before I just install it? So that's what I was talking about, and I got some great responses. I wanted to comment on one from Marty, and I'm just going to read to you straight from his email. He said it was okay. He said, wanted to offer a quick response to your podcast this week and to your rant about the consumerification of the OS. I agree with most of what you said, but you've always been one of those classic app for everything kind of users, which is true. I have. You have a zillion one-hit wonders that only do one thing, improve on some element of the graphic user interface or the OS that you've found to be deficient in some way. There's always that Mac feature that doesn't quite seem to cut it. And again, that is true. All that glitters is not gold, and people always want to improve on what Cupertino hands them. While there are certainly people out there who take their Macs out of the box and use them as is for years, you're not one of those people. And most of the MacCast users, I suspect, are in the same boat. Apple can hide buttons, isolate system files, dumb down the experience, but there will always be people for whom that approach just won't work. It's the nature of innovation and Mac users in general to seek out a better way. They'll always fight a process that tries to give them less flexibility in their computer systems. I applaud the resignation approach that you've started to follow, the letting go thing, but I'll give you 2 or 3 weeks of that before you're off the bandwagon. And I am willing to accept that that may very well be the case. And I agree with you. I think there are users out there that are going to want to tweak and always find a better way of doing things. And there's going to be great developers that are going to bring us tons of great ways to do that. I guess what I'm coming down to is what I was mentioning earlier, that I'm trying to be more reserved about my decisions and not just install every one-hit wonder that comes along because somebody recommends it to me. And I'm also trying to get in the process of doing that to less informed or less geeky users that I recommend stuff to. Rather than blanket recommending tools and utilities, I'm trying to dig deeper now and say, what are you trying to do on your system? And is there a system-level way of doing it that is good enough that you can stick with and you can stay inside the sandbox? Or do you really require some other external utility or tool to take you beyond? And at that point, you're moving from a basic consumer-level user into an intermediate advanced user. And it's just knowing that you're taking some risks or changing some things that could have implications down the line, but now you know and are aware of those things going on in your system. I think too often it's easy for us to, you know, recommend something to a friend or a family member, say, oh, just install this, and then they install it, run into some problem later, and don't even realize or know why that's going on. And when they go into a Genius Bar for an appointment, they can't even tell somebody, oh, I installed this thing, and that might be where the problem lies. So that's a little bit of what I was getting into, and I do think that Apple's doing the right thing in making computers and technology more approachable, more friendly, and even if that's closing off the walls or narrowing the sandbox a little bit, I'm going to say that's okay for us more technical geeky users because we can break out, we can expand the walls, and we can still do what we want. It just might be a little bit more difficult or a little bit more tricky, but we can still find those tricks. So thank you to Marty for sending in his feedback. Thanks to all of you who have sent in your feedback, and please send me more. I'd love to get some more audio comments and continue to comment on this because I think I'd like to hear from the real true geek perspective, but what I'm trying to fight is this sort of outcry from the geek community that Apple is being too restrictive because under the hood, we still have a lot of power. We still have the Unix underpinnings, and we can get in there and we can really blow this stuff out. There's still jailbreaking. There's still ways to hack this technology. It's not like Apple has thrown up roadblocks to stop that. They're just putting in protective layers that kind of hide that a little bit deeper. And I'm really saying that I'm okay with that. Okay, now let's turn the tables on Lion a little bit. I have to say, in general, I'm going to talk about my living with Lion for the past couple of weeks, but I'm going to say, in general, I've been very happy with the transition to Lion. It was a straightforward, really easy upgrade, even though I did the extra work of doing a clean install. I've talked to a number of people who have upgraded to Lion and just went through Apple's standard over-the-top install process from the Mac App Store. Almost 95% of the time, I'm hearing smooth sailing in terms of the upgrade itself, no issues with the process, and people are generally very happy. And I would count myself in that same boat. I've been generally very happy with the new operating system. I like the new features, love the new mail, the conversations features, all these things that I talked about on the previous episodes of the MacCast. But now, living with Lion for a while, it's showing a little bit of its warts. There are definitely some annoying quirks, little things that are bugging me. Nothing really killer or show-stopping beyond my audio interface not having updated drivers, but that's not Apple's fault. That's not Lion's fault. That's Elesis, the company that makes it. They did say that they're going to update their drivers. I just have no idea when. I don't know what this issue is of companies that make Mac software. I guess this is a side bug related to Lion, but companies that make Mac software who've had over a year to prepare for the Lion upgrade. Apple's developer program is cheap to get into, $99, and you can get into the program. Anybody can get into the program, and you have all the betas, you get the releases, you can test your stuff, you can try it out. I don't know why some developers, especially the major big ones, and you know who you are, I'm not going to name names, not updating their stuff. I think there's no excuse for it anymore. And these guys just need to step up and do that. But that's an aside. Some of the other annoying little quirks that I've noticed, one that's really frustrating me, and if anybody has a solution for this, please let me know. I cannot figure out anything beyond rebooting my system and resetting up the preference. But I had mentioned a tip about setting up a keyboard shortcut assignment for activating the launchpad, and I like to use my F8 key. So you can go into the system preferences, into the keyboard shortcuts, and assign a shortcut to that. And I've done that almost every time. At some point, it stops working. I just get this bonking noise, hit F8, it just does not work. And I don't know why that's going on, and I have to keep resetting up that shortcut. Another one that I noticed is with full screen mode and Safari. I'm enjoying using Safari in full screen mode. I really like having it on a separate screen. I think full screen is really ideal for those of us who have notebooks, smaller screens, and only one screen. If you're using two screens, there's another annoying bug many of you have let me know about, and that is, say you have two 27-inch displays. You go into full screen mode, you can only use one display. That's just dumb. I have no idea why it's set up like that. You should be able to have, you know, a desktop on one screen and a full screen app on another, or two full screen apps, whatever it is, Apple's going to need to get that sorted out. So that's just dumb. But the thing I've noticed in using Safari in full screen mode is occasionally my Safari tabs will lose their close button. So you have tabs open, and I'll have some tabs in the background, and if I want to close them, I go to hover over the tab, and normally you'll get that little X icon. For some reason, in my case, sometimes that X icon doesn't show up, and I actually have to click the tab and then click back, kind of click back and forth to get it to toggle to come back on. And I'm not sure what that's all about, but that's a really annoying bug that I've noticed. Another couple ones just with desktops in general and the new Spaces feature and stuff like that. Sometimes new instances of Safari, if I click a link in an application like Reader, my RSS Reader or something like that, and I have Safari open in full screen mode on another screen, rather than jumping over to that screen and opening up the browser in a tab in Safari or in a new window in the full screen Safari, it'll open up Safari, like another instance of Safari on the desktop. And I've seen this happen a couple times. Once again, beyond just triggering a link from another application, I don't know what causes that to happen. And I don't know if there's actually a way to merge that back in. I would imagine I could probably go through Mission Control and drag that back over to my, you know, the new window over to my full screen Safari window and probably get them to consolidate back together. But just weird, quirky stuff and jumping back and forth, you know, the sliding around between full screen apps and desktop apps gets a little motion sickness going on. But that's another aside. Wake from sleep and full screen apps not taking up the full screen. So I've had it situations where I've had Safari open in full screen mode. I've walked away from my Mac. My Mac's gone to sleep. And when I come back and open up, wake from sleep, for some reason, the Safari full screen app doesn't take up the full screen. It kind of slides over and it's just like a little half window. Something like that may be related to a tip I'm going to tell you about earlier, but I don't know why that happens automatically. It should stay full screened and full width in my window, in my opinion. My Finder windows have also disappeared completely. This was weird. This happened to me the other day. I was working in the Finder. Everything was going along fine. I think I was deleting some files, throwing some stuff to the trash from my downloads folder and emptying the trash. And then all of a sudden, poof, all my Finder windows disappeared. And I was trying to get them back. I didn't know what had happened. And I slid over to the left to where the new dashboard was. And guess what? All my Finder windows were on my dashboard. I have no idea how they got there. I have no idea how to make them go there. I've since tried to see if there's any way I can get my Finder windows to go into the dashboard. And I can't do it myself. But the operating system suddenly at one point decided that's where they should go. Luckily, just closing them in the dashboard desktop got them out of there, and then I was able to reopen new windows in the Finder. But very, very strange behavior. And then I swear the new autosave feature is occasionally messing up my typing. So what happens is usually after a pause, so if I'm working in a document that or an application that has autosave, working on a document, I pause for a minute maybe to go over and check Twitter or email or something like that, and then I come back and I go to start typing again, there's a delay and I get a beach ball, and then what happens is the first few characters that I started to type are missing, and then after a second or two it'll start typing the word that I was working on, and then suddenly the first couple characters will show up at the end of the word and I have to erase that and start typing over. I don't know why that's happening. It does seem to be related to the autosave, which does kick in when you take a pause when you're working on a document. So I think it's starting up the resources, and it's like the keyboard gets behind what's actually going on, but it has it in memory, so then it tries to catch up, but by the time it's caught up, it's all messed up. Another really annoying one I've noticed is with the eyedropper cursor. I'm calling it the eyedropper bug. And it seems to be in any application that lets me sample colors from the color palette. So, you know, Apple kind of has that universal color picker palette, and you've got that little magnifying glass where you can click and you can actually sample a color. Or maybe you didn't know about that tip. Maybe I'm giving you a tip at the same time. But you can sample colors from anywhere on your screen. And I use this in applications like Acorn and Photoshop. There's also one I use in my web development called the Digital Color Meter, which is a utility that's built into Mac OS X that lets you sample colors from anywhere in the operating system. And what happens is when I use that tool, I sample my color, suddenly my cursor completely disappears. It's gone, and I can still hover over stuff. I notice if I move my mouse around, it can activate things, but there's just no cursor visible. And the only way I figured out to get it back is to slide my mouse all the way up to the toolbar, click in the toolbar area, and then it will show back up and I can start using the mouse again. And it happens in every application that uses that color picker. So I don't know why that's going on, but those are the kind of quirky things that I found. I'm sure you've found some of your own. So send those in, especially if you have fixes or workarounds for any of the quirks. Send those along too, so we can start sharing those tips and tricks and stuff like that on the MacCast. And then just in general, I've noticed in Lion that I'm seeing more beach balls than I would think I should be seeing, especially given the fact that I did do a really extreme clean install. And I don't know, but I think it might possibly be related to how many open applications I have running normally and the fact that I have 4 gigs of RAM on my MacBook Pro. I'm thinking that I might just need more RAM. I might need 8 gigs considering all the things that I have open in a given day, or maybe I just need to start closing up more applications. Another thing that's in the back of my mind, sort of nitpicking, is the fact that, and I talked about this, I believe, on the last episode, Safari has this new sandboxing built into it, and Safari seems to eat up a lot more memory and a lot more resources. If you look at what it's doing in the activity monitor, it has this new process that's where all the sandboxing goes on, and that starts eating up memory. And I have Safari open and running in the background a lot now on a full screen desktop. So it could be Safari eating that up, and again, me just needing more memory. Now, one that hasn't hit me that's plagued a lot of people that I want to talk about is the wake from sleep bug. And this is being reported by a number of users, mostly of newer MacBook Pros, well, 2010 MacBook Pros and some iMacs. And there might actually be two issues, because I've heard about that with the 2010 MacBook Pros, and there's also another one related to, I believe, the new 2011 iMacs. So either of those models, if you're having weird wake from sleep bugs, the most common one seems to be that the video goes completely black when you're trying to wake from sleep. So I don't know if it flashes or flickers, because I haven't actually seen it myself, but you just get a black screen, it's unresponsive, not waking from sleep, and you have to do a hard reset to get it to reboot. I think that's the one that's plaguing the 2010 MacBook Pros and iMacs, and seems to be specifically related to the models with the NVIDIA 330M graphics processor. The other one, the one that I'm hearing about kind of on the 2011 iMacs, seems to be you go to wake from sleep and you end up with scrambled video, something that looks like static, might be triggered after waking from sleep and then going to play some kind of QuickTime or Flash or any kind of video content, and then suddenly your system locks up, becomes unresponsive, and you have to hard reboot to reset it. So there's some GPU stuff going on. Apple seems to have been plagued by GPU software firmware issues for a while now in a lot of the Intel models. I don't know what that's specifically all about. There is a theory running around about the 2010 MacBook Pro iMac issue related to the NVIDIA 330M graphics processor. There seems to be a workaround for fixing that, where if you turn off the CPU auto switching in the energy saver, that it's the automatic graphics switching that's causing this bug. The other thing that people are saying works is just turning off completely going to sleep, so it doesn't trigger the bug. So turn off your CPU sleep and your display sleep in energy saver. I really wouldn't recommend that one. I would recommend turning off the automatic graphics switching, which I think forces it to use exclusively the discrete NVIDIA processor. The only bummer there is that both of those fixes will actually have some negative impact on your battery life. So if you're running, you know, totally on battery power, that might not be a great fix for you. But at least until Apple can patch these issues and issue a patch or issue an update for them, it's probably going to be the way to go if you've been affected by that bug. Luckily, knock on wood, I haven't seen that bug personally, but I could imagine how frustrating it would be for those of you who have been hit by that. And then I have a couple of questions from some listeners. Let me play you this one from Ben about Lion and QuickTime exporting.
Hi, Adam. It's Ben calling from the UK here. I do a lot of wedding videos and other videos, medical videos and product videos. And my workflow, especially with the weddings, I tend to do a free iPad or iPhone version. And the way I've done this before is in Snow Leopard, I've basically done the videos, exported them as HD files, and then opened them up in QuickTime X, and then done the whole share thing, which says share, and then iTunes, and it says what type do you want. Anyway, I've been doing that for several years, well, a couple of years, and it's all been running fine. Now, I've only just updated to Lion. I thought I'd follow the same workflow, didn't think anything of it, and I've gone on to I've loaded my videos up into QuickTime X, the Lion version, did the share thing, there's lots more options now, went to iTunes, did that, got the compression bar came up, and it did it, you know, really quickly, about a minute. And bear in mind, these are 20-30 gig files that they're converting, so I was a bit suspicious. Anyway, went into the iTunes library after that, and all I saw was the audio file of that, which is not really what I'm after. I just didn't know whether this is a known bug or if I'm doing something wrong. I can't think that I am, but I'm maybe doing something wrong. But I just want to be able to really go into that workflow and keep with that workflow, because that's what I'm familiar with. I've done the whole handbrake thing in the past, and I'm not too bothered about doing that again, to be honest, but I will if I have to. But yeah, just didn't know what your thoughts were, and just to let you know, the show's great, and I tune in every week whilst I cut the grass on the farm here. All right, cheers, bye.
Hey, so hopefully your grass is nice and short now. Probably with the length of these episodes, it might get too short. So be careful out there when you're mowing the grass. But yeah, I'm not sure that even using Handbrake will solve your problem. I've had some QuickTime video issues as well. I noticed that a bunch of my older videos, when I bring them up in QuickTime 7 or QuickTime 10, excuse me, in QuickTime 10, have grayed out options for the sharing, and I'm not sure why I can't share them at all. Other videos come up just fine. So what I've been doing is opening them up in QuickTime 7, which I also installed. Now I installed it from my Snow Leopard DVD before upgrading, before I applied the Lion Over the Top installer, and it seems to be running just fine. I've talked to some other people since then who have said they've tried to install QuickTime 7 from their Snow Leopard DVDs after upgrading to Lion, and it says that they already have a newer version installed and doesn't seem to let them install it. So I don't know if you would need to drag it over from an old backup if you wanted to get QuickTime 7 running, but you might try using QuickTime 7 and see if it has the additional export features. Now, that version, you're going to have to make sure you have your QuickTime Pro key ready to get the additional features. If you remember QuickTime, you had to upgrade to QuickTime Pro to get some of the more advanced editing and export features and stuff like that. So if you have a copy of QuickTime 7, you might try that. In my case, I'm wondering if it has to do with when the videos were generated, although it sounds like you're doing newer videos from a newer HD camcorder. But I have to wonder, at least in my case, if it doesn't have to do with the endianness of my files. And this is something I never thought I'd have to dive into, but I'll give you kind of some of the technical details. What I noticed was when I would open up these videos and those options were grayed out, the videos that I would bring up in QuickTime, if I brought up the QuickTime info window, it labeled those files as being big endian, especially in the audio files, and end like END, endian. It might sound like I'm saying Indian, but I'm not. Big endian. And from Wikipedia, if you check on it, says the term endian or endianness refers to the ordering of individually addressable subcomponents within the representation of a larger data item as stored in external memory. External memory in this case being the file on your hard drive. So deciphering all that, what it comes down to is endianness is important as a low-level attribute of a particular data format. So a file that's stored on there. Really, what you need to know about endianness is that PowerPC had one method of endianness, and Intel has another method of endianness, big endian versus little endian. And we don't need to know the technical details, but we just need to know this is, might be a legacy thing in my case from the PowerPC. I'm not sure it is in your case, Ben, but I want to present this in case somebody else has noticed weird line issues with QuickTime videos. So I think what's happening is I exported those QuickTime videos when I was on PowerPC, and I've kind of brought them along, and now I'm wondering if QuickTime is having a hard time processing those files because of that low-level storage formatting representation stuff. And probably if I just convert them now using QuickTime 7 or some other tool, that would work. I haven't tried this yet. I'm wondering if I might have export issues like you've been having. Others, like yourself, have been reporting odd QuickTime issues after upgrading, things like no playback of some files or audio only or video only after doing conversions and things like that. And I have to wonder if it might be a codec issue. A couple people who have emailed me have even noted that QuickTime 10 will pop up and say a required codec isn't available. And with some of the HD camcorders, I know that different manufacturers have specific codecs that they use that may or may not be installed as part of the operating system. And it is possible that maybe Apple had some codecs that were installed under Snow Leopard that aren't there anymore for one reason or another under Lion, probably something related to the dropping of Rosetta support. Maybe some of the manufacturers didn't update some of their older codecs or drivers to support non-Rosetta. I don't know how that factors in from a developer standpoint, but you might try checking and see if you need to install some additional codecs. There's tools out there like Parian, which is kind of, they call it the Swiss Army knife of QuickTime codecs. It does look like it mostly supports Lion. I haven't reinstalled it yet. I'm a little bit nervous about it because it does install a number of different codecs. It looks like there might be some incompatibility between Parian and if you have installed the 3 IVX. I think that's a variant of DivX. 3 IVX codecs. Also DivX codecs, and another one is Flip for Mac, which lets you play WMV files. Those are the Microsoft media player components that you can download for free from Microsoft. There's also a commercial version of Flip for Mac. But those are all different codecs that you can add on top of QuickTime. So I'm wondering if you might be missing some of the codecs that are required for your camera. So you might check with your camera manufacturer and see if they have some information about Lion on their website. That's just a good general tip. If you've noticed you have specifically third-party hardware or other devices that might require drivers, you probably do want to go to their support website and check their FAQs, see if they don't have some updates and information about their Lion compatibility. And then if they do have Lion compatible updates, go ahead and reinstall those updates, and that might get you back up and running. If anybody else has another tip or trick about these video issues or QuickTime issues, let us know, and I'll try and pass that information along. I also have another question from Randy, this time about backup strategies and if we need to change those now that we're running Lion.
Hi, Adam. This is Randy out in Phoenix, Arizona. I've got a question for you from this longtime MacCast fan and listener, and it's regarding backups and what you might be considering changing with your backup strategy with Lion coming. I've been using Time Machine ever since buying a time capsule. In addition to Time Machine backups, I also have an external drive mounted to my iMac that nightly does a clone and updates the clone with Super Duper. And I ask about this because it strikes me that with the documents feature coming in Lion, which is kind of like a mini Time Machine for your documents, I'm almost wondering if the combination of having those documents, the versions saved from within the OS, and then having the clone, if that might be enough, actually, and if Time Machine is really worth the extra drive space and time and bandwidth and everything else that it takes to run. I'd like your feedback and hear your thoughts about that. Thanks.
Hey, Randy. Yeah, the short answer is I have not changed my backup strategy at all. I am still doing Time Machine. I am still using Super Duper, and I'm still doing my cloud-based backup to CrashPlan. So I have two external drives hooked to each one of my Macs, one doing a nightly Super Duper clone of the entire hard drive to an external drive, and then I have Time Machine running to another external drive that is double the storage size of my internal. So if I have a 500 gig internal drive, I have a 1 terabyte external drive, and I'm doing Time Machine backups. And just on Apple's general schedule, I haven't tweaked anything, or I'm not running any third-party utilities to change that. Now, your question brought up some more questions from me about, well, what is actually going on with versions and autosave? And yeah, could that kind of replace that coupled with a Time Machine backup? Could that serve almost the same purpose as a Time Machine plus Super Duper backup, which I think is kind of the question that you're getting to? And so when I looked into some of the support articles on Apple's website about autosave and versions, here's a couple things that I learned, and I don't know that they're necessarily going to change my backup strategy, and probably shouldn't change yours either. But the way autosave works is Lion, if an application has autosave enabled, and that's one thing to think about too, is all of the apps that you use are going to have to be updated to support this feature, or these features. So if they don't support these features, you're not going to gain the benefit. So you're probably still going to want to have your Time Machine backup to catch all of the applications that haven't adopted support for autosave and versions. And I think autosave and versions only really work in document-based apps. I'm not sure that they work for other types of apps. But the way autosave works is Lion, during pauses in your work, it's working in the background, and it will save if you take a pause. And if you're working continuously, it's going to save every 5 minutes. So either of those situations, it'll actually do a save of your file. There's also a lock feature, which allows you to lock a document to prevent any unexpected changes. And if the lock will actually get enabled automatically. I've already seen this on a couple of my files. I'll go to open some old files, and it'll say the file's locked, and I don't remember locking it. Well, that's part of the autosave system. So 2 weeks after the last time you edited that file, it will auto lock it in Lion. Now, you can change this interval actually in the system settings. If you go into the time machine preferences, and I think this is kind of confusing too, because I've heard mixed opinions on whether or not autosave or versions requires time machine to be enabled. And it's my understanding that they don't. We did some testing and somebody confirmed that they were able to get autosave and versions working with time machine turned off. So I don't think the two are related, but this setting is in the time machine preferences. So if you go into your time machine preferences and you look at the options button, click on that, you'll see that there are options to set when it will auto lock documents. In the pop-up menu, you can select between 1 day, 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, or 1 year, and the default is 2 weeks. So that's how the autosave portion works. On the versions side of things, what happens is Lion automatically creates a new version of a document every time you open it, and then each hour after that while you're working on it. Now, you can also automatically save a version by doing what we used to think of as a document save, a command S or a file save. It's now called file save a version in applications that have the version feature support turned on. And that's going to save a point. And the thing about versions is it only saves the information that has changed since the last time you saved a version. So it's not going to eat up a bunch of hard disk space. Now, this got me thinking, well, where is all that version information saved? So I did a little bit of digging, and this is one of those things where us technical geeky people, we can go discover this stuff, but it really is hidden pretty deep and protected from the average user. But right at the root of your boot hard drive is a new hidden file called .documentrevisions-v100. And one of these hidden files is created on each volume that you have documents on that you're working off of with applications that support versions. So it saves it actually to the volume as long as that volume is HFS plus formatted. And then it will retain the revisions of those files in that little hidden directory. There's a whole structure. I kind of poked in there just to take a look. I didn't really understand all the bits and pieces, but all of the document revisions are stored within there. Interestingly enough, I discovered that if you create a copy of a document, either in the Finder on the same volume or across volumes, those revisions are not saved. And that may be a key factor in deciding not to rely on versions and your SuperDuper clone as a backup. Now, my assumption is that because SuperDuper is doing a full bit-for-bit clone, if you restored from your SuperDuper drive to a new hard drive, that hidden document, and I did look in the SuperDuper logs and confirm it is backing up the .document revisions file, that would come back, and I assume all your versions would come back. But if you're just doing an archive of a document, say, and you wanted to go back and get those revisions, that's not going to work. If you just copy a file from one hard drive to another, and then you open that same file from the other hard drive, you'll notice none of the revisions are there. When you go into the versions view, it'll say it has no saved revisions because it hasn't saved a new revision into the document revisions folder on that new drive that you moved the file to. So that becomes a really significant thing. The other thing to note is that if you save or are working on a file in an application that supports versions, but that file is stored on a volume that's not HFS plus formatted, what it'll do is it'll save those revisions into the document revisions hidden folder on the root hard drive until you quit that application. Then it will only retain the last copy of that on the non-HFS plus formatted version. So the versions feature does rely on HFS plus formatting to actually retain that version data. So all those factors go into the thing of, do you really want to rely on versions as your secondary backup system? And I think the answer is no. I would continue to use SuperDuper. Versions is more additive, not something meant, I think, to replace that backup strategy. But that's just my thoughts. I'd love to hear other dissenting opinions or agreeing opinions. You can send me feedback and email to maccast@gmail.com. And while we're on the topic of working with document-based applications and Lion, Matt Newberg over at Tidbits noticed something very interesting, and it could be a bit concerning if you didn't realize this was part of a feature in Lion. So try this little trick. It may or may not work for you. It really depends on probably how much is going on your system at any given time. If you have a lot of apps open, and you might want to open some additional apps before you try this trick. So open up Safari, open up, you know, a few browser tabs, maybe a couple applications, iMovie, iPhoto, iTunes, have a bunch of things open, really kind of be taxing your system. And then open up a text edit application or document, rather, in Lion. And then also probably a good thing to do so you can actually see this working is open up your activity monitor. So go into Applications Utilities, open up the activity monitor, and sort the processes by name and make sure that you can see the kind of text edit process running in the background. Then go back to the text edit application and close any open text edit document windows. Don't quit the application, and you can confirm that you haven't quit it by looking at the text edit menu in the menu bar. That should still be there. And also looking at the activity monitor, you should see text edit running. Now with that open, just navigate away from text edit to another application on the same desktop and notice what happens. Chances are that text edit will suddenly just quit all on its own, or look like it quit, because if you look at the activity monitor, and I tried this on my system, it definitely did work. If you look at the activity monitor, text edit will still be there and running, but your typical things of going back to the application, say like doing a command tab to get back to that application, you'll notice it's no longer in the running applications list. It's not in the dock. It's not anywhere to be found. And you might think that, well, this is a huge bug in Lion. It's suddenly just like quitting applications that I was working in. It turns out it's actually not a bug, but a feature called automatic termination, or I'm calling it the, oh, were you using that feature of Lion. John Siracusa from Ars Technica explained a lot in his massive Lion review, if you read through that. But basically, he says this: Lion will quit running applications behind your back if it decides it needs the resources and if you don't appear to be using them. The heuristic for determining whether an application is, quote, in use is very conservative. It must not be the active application. It must have no visible non-minimized window. That's why we closed the open document window for text edit but didn't quit the application. And it also must support this new automatic termination feature. And if it has all those things in place and your system suddenly needs or decides it needs more resources, it can actually shut down that application to reclaim some of those system resources and memory and stuff like that. The weird part about this is the fact that Activity Monitor kind of still shows it sitting there, although I have a feeling that the application transitions into that, you know, sort of inactive memory area if we really kind of delved into this deeper. But it also turns out that an application can automatically terminate an app even if it has open windows or minimized windows if there's a couple of other conditions that are met, and that is that it still has to support the auto termination feature, but it also has to support auto save and be a document-based application. So that means that you're not going to lose your changes, right? Because it can actually quit the file or shut down the application with an open document, but it's going to be in auto save. And it also needs to support the resume feature so that when you relaunch that application, your document comes back auto saved and at the same place and kind of in the same state that you already were working in. But that is a Lion feature, albeit I think a weird one, and that is one of those that I think is counterintuitive to Apple's new consumerization stuff. Quitting applications in the background when you don't know that that's actually going to happen might be a little bit confusing to the average consumer, and there's definitely a technical answer to this, but I mean, how would you ever figure this out beyond listening to this podcast or reading, you know, an Ars Technica article or something like that? I just really don't know how the average user would know this was going on. So I wanted to point it out in case you had run across that and thought Lion might be acting up when it isn't. One of the things I love about being in a community of Mac geeks like this is that questions will come up and I will have to go find answers, and which means I get to learn and you get to learn and we get to find out stuff. And this week I got an email from Adam, and he actually had a numbers document that he was working with and wanted to be able to search for matches in one column and then just update the data in another column for only the elements that matched that search criteria, and was looking for a way to do that. I'm not a huge numbers user. I have the application, but I don't use it on a daily basis, but it caused me to go in and kind of search out and seek the answer, and I was actually able to find it using the normal method, my first inclination was, of course, hey, just do a find and replace. But the thing is that only does the data that you find, and then you have to replace it. In this case, he wanted to actually more filter the columns that he was looking at, and then just update the data for only those columns kind of all in one place. It was almost like creating a secondary view or a filtered view of that information. So I went looking for this answer, and it turns out the answer was in the reorganize pane inside numbers. So you have your numbers document open, and then you select the table that you want to work on. And then from the toolbar, there's a little reorganize button, or you can go up to the table menu and choose show reorganize panel. And then what you do is you check the option that says show rows that match the following, and then you have a selection criteria, some options. So what you want to do is you want to add the filter criteria that you need, and it will adjust your table view so that you see just the rows that match that criteria. So you enter the criteria, and you need to press enter to actually activate it to get it to update in the main window. And then as long as that checkbox is checked for that option, the show rows that match the following, it's going to filter on that view. And then you can work with it just like it was a normal table, but it's going to have just the matching rows and columns that that met your criteria. And you can do it by rows or columns. There's a couple different options for actually doing the filtering. And then you can go through and you can update your data. And then when you're done, you have a couple of different options. You can simply uncheck that box, which will untoggle it, but will keep your selection criteria in place in case you needed to come back and reorganize or refilter on those options. Or you can hit the reset button, which will completely blow out the filter, and then you can start over again. So if you need to do different types of sorting or reorganizing and filtering, you can do that. You have to be careful, though, because the filter will stick if you leave it checked, and if you just close that reorganize box, it might not be obvious that you're actually doing any kind of reorganizing and filtering, because in the window, it just looks like your table is just that data. So if you did that and you saved the document and sent it off to someone else, I don't know if it would come up in that filtered state. My assumption is that it would. So you're going to want to make sure you clear it, especially before sharing that document. But Adam, that's how you do it. And I was able to learn something new. So thanks for sending in that question. For a lot of us, I think we're starting to notice that the Apple ID, your identity with Apple, is starting to become increasingly more important and more significant, especially if you've been using iTunes, you have an iPod, an iPad, an iPhone in the last few years, if you have a Mobile Me account, if you're using the Mac App Store, that really is becoming your one access point to all of your purchase history. With Apple's new updates we were talking about with the TV shows and music and stuff like that, it really is becoming a critical part of your Mac, your Apple, your iLife. And recently, with Apple announcing the iCloud and the Apple ID being tied into that, it's gaining more and more significance. And a lot of us have a lot of questions that I think Apple has left unanswered. Questions like this one from David.
Hello, Adam. This is Dave calling from Dublin in Ireland. Actually, before I recorded this, I just worked out that I've been listening to your show since 2005. So it's been 6 long years. So I just want to say thanks for all the great shows. And I look forward to another 6 years plus. So thank you for that. The reason I'm calling is I just want to get your thoughts on Apple IDs and iTunes IDs. I'm sure I'm not the only one thinking about this, but with iCloud coming online soon and iTunes Match and iOS 5, it seems like your Apple ID or your iTunes ID is becoming more and more important to your kind of digital life as such. I mean, I've got four Apple IDs at the moment, one for my business because the billing goes through my business for that. I've one for personal use for, you know, music and stuff like that. My wife has an ID. I also have a Mobile Me account that I use for syncing and iCal and bits and pieces. So I'm just wondering, you know, how can I manage this going forward? Or, you know, have Apple got some way of actually consolidating multiple Apple IDs? Because it seems like how it's going to work now is that, you know, you go into a store, you pick up an iPhone, you punch in your ID, and then it just builds your iPhone by pulling all your, you know, all your apps and your photos and music and everything off the cloud. And I can't imagine it's going to ask you for, you know, four or five different IDs. I mean, Apple like to keep things simple, so as I do. And, you know, I was just wondering, is there some kind of way to make this easier? I'm sure I'm not the only one with the problem, and I'm sure you have listeners who, you know, who would like to, you know, hear your comments or share some comments about what might happen in the future. So thanks for taking the call.
Hey, Dave, thanks for posing the question. I think it is something that we need to start discussing, and a lot of people have asked me about this. I mean, the reality is that Apple's ID system, in my opinion, is kind of a mess. I think there's a lot of people like yourself, myself included, who have many different Apple IDs. You also have the dilemma of family members. You might have a family and they could have four or five IDs between the different family members, each used for iTunes and their own iPod and iPhone. But if you want to start sharing your media, your documents, or your application, not documents, your applications, excuse me, then those are tied to a specific Apple ID, and you kind of have to register or at least tell each Mac or device to use that ID to kind of authorize that app or that media file, and those authorizations get used up, and you may or may not want to share a single ID between all family members. You might have specific reasons for having different ones, and it's all tied then into your purchase history, and that's another topic that came up. You may or may not want to share your purchase history. Somebody sent me an email and said, is there any way for me to suppress certain purchases from, say, my grandkids? I might have certain apps that I bought for myself, but I don't necessarily want them knowing when they go into iTunes and look at my past purchases, what movies I bought or TV shows I'm watching and things like that. And I think that's a valid thing. But if you have to kind of share a single Apple ID between all your different family members, then they're going to have access to see that information. I couldn't go in and find any way to actually clear or suppress specific purchases from your history. So if anybody knows how to do that, let us know. But with Lion and iOS 5, they seem to be integrating the Apple ID even further. As a matter of fact, your Apple ID is part of your setup of your new device. And I think you're right. I think Apple's ultimate goal is that when you get a new device, you'll be able to just plug in your Apple ID during the setup, and it's going to go out, and it's going to go to the App Store, and it's going to go to the iTunes Store, and it'll be able to pull down any files or media or applications that you don't have installed on that system and prompt you and ask you, hey, do you want me to reset this up just like your old system? And you're not going to have to go through that manual install process anymore. It auto sets up your mail and pulls down your address book contacts from the iCloud and your calendars and stuff like that. And it's all tied to that ID. And if you have multiple IDs, how do you deal with that? And I guess one possible way that I've thought about this is if you look at how IDs are being handled with FaceTime and the new iMessage features, they have a hint of one possible way. As it is right now, as far as I know, and I've looked into this a little bit, there is no Apple official way to kind of consolidate multiple Apple IDs into one account. And the stranger thing is that that Apple ID is used in different places and for different reasons. And I think one of the ways some of us have ended up with multiple Apple IDs is that you registered some products on Apple's website and they're under one ID, and then you changed your email address and now they're under a new ID. And suddenly you've got these IDs and they kind of grow of their own accord. Apple, at least as far as I know, has no way to actually consolidate those things. But the one thing I have seen them doing, and again, it's in FaceTime and iMessage, is that they allow you to use a single Apple ID as your login, but then in the settings for those apps, you can actually associate other email addresses. And I would imagine Apple could do a similar thing to, say, associate additional IDs under sort of one umbrella ID or one account. So not necessarily merging the IDs, but saying, okay, your login is going to be this ID, but you also own, and I don't know how they would validate, but they'd have to have some sort of process to validate that you own that ID, probably just plugging in your password, and kind of put them all into one settings panel and say, all of these IDs are me or my identity. Or you could even have something similar for a group, say like a family. You could say, okay, these are our family IDs, and if anybody logs into any of these systems using one of these IDs, it's attached to this content that we've purchased. Apple is going to have to do something, and the reality is, I think this is one of those cases where they really haven't, they're plowing forward, they're getting ready for iCloud and stuff like that, and I don't think they've thought through all the little nuances that a lot of us are thinking about. And there's a lot of ideas flowing around out there. I think giving feedback to Apple on this issue would be a good thing. So go to Apple's feedback page and say, look, I'm concerned about this Apple ID thing. I want to consolidate. I want to bring all the my purchases over with me, but I've got, you know, this stuff under this ID and that stuff under that ID. You got to give us a way to consolidate this stuff or bring it all together under a single ID. And I think for sure Apple's going to address the issue at some point. How they're actually going to do it, I think we really don't know yet. I think that's yet to be determined. But I think once iCloud hits and people start really registering Apple IDs, and now that we have more iOS devices out there, I think Apple's going to have to come up with a solution sooner than later. And hopefully we'll be hearing about that very soon, because I know I'd like to get my Apple IDs under control. If any of you have any thoughts or opinions or know of a way to consolidate IDs some back-end way, I have heard that sometimes if you call up Apple, they have internal methods for consolidating some information. I don't know if they can actually consolidate the IDs. I know that they, like for product registrations, can move them from one ID to another, but I think that old ID kind of still sticks around just with no data in it. And I think that's one way they can handle it, but they're going to have an online process or something for us end users to manage this. All right, let's finish out the day with a cool little tip that I got from Dan, one of our listeners, a good friend of the show. I actually had an opportunity to meet Dan at Macworld a couple times. He's a really great guy. And he pointed out a cool Safari trick in Lion. And I haven't seen this mentioned anyplace else. And I don't know how I missed the feature myself. But it specifically is for those of us who use Safari in full screen mode. Websites can kind of have either what you call a static width, in other words, a fixed width layout, or what's called a fluid layout, meaning that no matter how wide your browser is, it will flow the text to that width. And that's great if you have a small screen, say a 15-inch screen or a 17-inch screen. But now with the new full screen mode, those types of sites that have the fluid width, if you blow them up full screen on a 27-inch or a 30-inch display, it can get really hard to scan across that much width and say read through an article or something like that. And so a lot of websites are taking the tact of moving to fixed width layouts, but some of us really like to have fluid width layouts. And it turns out in Safari, you can actually control the width of a fluid width layout in full screen mode, but it's not really obvious. What you do is just move your cursor all the way to the edge of the screen, and what will happen is the cursor icon will change to that little bar with the double arrows, the little resize handle, just as if it were in a floating window on the desktop, but it's right there at the edge of the screen. And then you can simply just drag that in and it will scale from both sides the width of that browser window within the tab. And you get the Apple's kind of standard gray, steely canvas background behind it in the areas where there aren't any, you know, where there's no website background or anything like that. And you can adjust the size to a width that's comfortable for you for reading. And even cooler is that it's tab specific. So if you have other tabs open, you can have each tab have a different width. You can have one be full width, and you can bring up different websites in the different widths, and it's going to actually retain that. Could also be a cool feature for cropping out colored backgrounds on fixed width sites. So if you have some site and it's got a bright red background on a 30-inch display, you know, if the website layout's just in the middle taking up, say, 1,000 pixels or something like that, and you have all this extra bright red stuff, you might want to crop that out because it might just be too glaring or too garish to be actually looking at and reading. So you could use this feature in that way also. So just a very cool little tip and feature, something that wasn't very obvious, and thanks to Dan for pointing that one out. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze, check out their software. The new version with Lion compatibility is available. You can find more information and details at phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, great application, perfect time to pick it up for back to school. You can find more information and details and get a trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, awesome applications. You should have every single one of them in your Apple arsenal. You can find more information and details and trials over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, get cash for that old iPod, that iPad. If you're looking to do an upgrade, maybe to a new iPhone 5 in the fall, think about gazelling it. Gazelle.com for more information and details. And a new sponsor to the MacCast, FreshBooks. You know, I work for myself and I have to do invoicing. FreshBooks makes that completely easy. It's an online service. You can sign up for a free account. And if you do right now, they're giving free cake. I mean, who doesn't like free cake? If you enter MacCast in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you sign up for your free account, each week they're going to give one person who signed up from the MacCast a free birthday cake. So get your free cake, sign up for free, and check it out. FreshBooks.com is the URL. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Thank you to you for your support of the show, for continuing to listen, staying subscribed, and sending in your comments and your feedback and stuff like that. I love getting that stuff. If you'd like to support the show even further, you can do that by becoming a MacCast member. For about $4 a month, you get extra content. There's actually different plans, so you can save more if you get a longer plan, like a six-month or a one-year plan. It works out to be even less money per month. But you can get all the details and information on that over at member.maccast.com, and I'd love to have you as a MacCast member. And all of those of you who are already members, thank you for your support of the show. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, questions, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. You can leave voicemail there. Or if you're on Skype, you can use the Skype name The MacCast. That's my contact there, and I have a voicemail on Skype. So you can leave voicemail there, save on some long-distance charges. And if you need links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of The MacCast, you can find those in the show notes. Those are at maccast.com. Just check the post for the episode that you're interested in, and the little link's down there at the bottom. It says show notes in HTML. Click on that and you'll get nice HTML formatted show notes. They're also available in OPML if you know what that is for the more technically geeky inclined. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. And you can also find me online between shows on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast, or over on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. And that'll do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.